and welcome to the Libby's podcast, conversations with authors who've been shortlisted for the British Book Awards, lovingly known as the Nibbies. I'm your host and longtime Nibbies fan, Hannah McInnes. These awards celebrate books and everyone who makes them, honouring the entire creative, collaborative journey of a book, from the author's mind to the reader's hand. And that's what we're going to do on this podcast. Chat to some of today's best-loved authors about their books, their writing, what's gone on behind the scenes to get them to where they are, and those lovely moments when they and the books they've created have found their readers.
I'm Satnam Sangera. I'm a writer and an author and a journalist, and I guess I'm shortlisted this year in the Nibbies for my children's book, Stolen History.
You are indeed. Stolen History, then, tell us what it is in your words and why, after Empire Land, you wanted to write something that was specifically for children.
Well, Empire Land was very popular with students of kind of GCSE A-level age, and I'm endlessly getting messages from them saying it's inspired them to study history for A-level or even university, which is amazing. But I also get a lot of messages from people saying, I really loved Empire Land. I'd love to give my children something. And so Stolen History kind of grew out of that, out of a kind of desire amongst lots of people to tell children the basics of the British Empire, the stuff that we were never taught at school, but we wish we had been taught.
Why weren't we taught it?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think we have certain national narratives in this country about World War One, World War Two, and the Tudors. And for some reason, we like to forget that we were responsible for the biggest empire in human history, even though it was the biggest thing we ever did. I suspect because the history is very fractious and people argue about every single aspect of empire, when it began, when it ended, why it began, whether it ever ended, was it racist, was it good or bad? All these questions are ultimately unanswerable. So it's better and easier to just talk about the Tudors.
And you know better than a lot of people how fractious it is, and you've experienced not the greatest reaction from certain people, haven't you, for Empire Land? But you carried on going, and you say it's so important to you doing this work. And I just wonder why that is, what drives you to keep going, and you've given us Stolen History, now, of course, Empire World.
I think mainly because I feel like this history, overall, knowing about it has been positive for me in that it explains my position in this multicultural society I've been born into, explains my Sikh identity. And ultimately, I think it's healthy for this country to understand it because, you know, we're going out in the world at the moment because of Brexit, trying to reestablish relationships with the planet. And we don't remember what we did the last time we turned up on people's doorsteps, but they do. So there's a gap between the way the world sees us and the way we see ourselves. And I think it's essential that we narrow that gap. And so that's one of the reasons why I carry on.
So how did you, this is really interests me, how you got the tone right, which you do. It's incredibly informative. It's clear, it's concise. Stolen History, of course, this is, but it's also very entertaining. There's sort of a lightness to it, even though the subject is incredibly serious and asks such profound questions. I just wonder how you did that, strike the right tone, the right balance, making it accessible for children.
I think it's because the history does not have to be contentious. It depends how you approach it. If you approach it in a macro way or in a ethical kind of approach, then yeah, it's going to be contentious. But if you break it down and just look at items in the everyday lives of children, like tea, and explain the imperial origins, or sugar, or, you know, the crown jewels, or London Zoo, or the Jungle Book. These are things which are in kids' lives, or the Scouts, which were set up famously by an imperialist to create an imperial generation to make sure we didn't lose the battle with Germany and other European powers. If you explain it in those terms, it's not necessarily contentious, and also it's very accessible history, because this stuff, this history and the legacies of the empire surround everything we do, explains a lot of things in our daily lives, explains a lot of things in the news.
And so how did you find it, the experience? You're obviously an incredibly seasoned writer, spend most of your life writing. How did you find switching to writing for children? Was there a certain way you had to kind of get into that mindset?
I actually found it worryingly easy. I think it's because I tend to make jokes, and I sometimes think this is a character failure, that I always have to make a joke, even if I'm writing about something very serious, like, say, my family's schizophrenia, the illness, I mean. And, you know, I actually now think it's not a character failure. I actually think it brings people in that it can make really dense, difficult subjects accessible, and it's really important for kids. And also, you've got to not assume a lot of knowledge with kids, and it helps that I knew very little about the empire just 5 years ago, so it's not hard for me to access that ignorance. I still remember not knowing anything.
I mean, you've touched on this, but what was your main hope that the readers and the children would take away from it?
Yeah, my main hope is that, you know, people grow up realizing that we're a multicultural country because we had a multicultural empire. We have kind of regular racist crises in this country, like, say, the Stephen Lawrence murder or the Windrush scandal, and there's always a report. And the report, I read them, always says one of the solutions to this is to teach the history of empire, because then people, civil servants, football fans, men on the street, people will understand that we are multicultural for a reason, that people are here not because they come here uninvited. They're here for deep historical reasons going back centuries. Mm. And people from Africa and Asia, parts of the empire there, fought for in both world wars. So if we understand this history, I think it helps us to become a step closer to being a more tolerant, multicultural society.
In that sense, then, perhaps this book is almost the most important, because it's the kids learning now. It's here where these massive gaps in the curriculum can be filled in and redressed and society changed. You can't really underestimate, can you, the power of that particular book and that age group?
Yeah, I think, yeah, get them early. But also, weirdly, I find that talking to kids about this history is much easier than talking to adults. Because when you say to adults, you know, this history is profoundly contradictory. You know, empire resulted in democracy and geopolitical instability. It resulted in environmental destruction, but also the birth of environmentalism. Adults really struggle with those contradictions, but I think kids get it. Often I say to kids, look, you know, your parents, you love them, but aren't they also the most irritating people on the planet? And they instantly get it. And in a way that I think adults don't.
I was going to ask you, because a lot of what the bookseller and the British Book Awards looks at is the publishing journey of the book, not just the writing and everything that's in your head, but also the publishing experience and, most importantly, the meeting of readers. And I just wonder, I mean, you did 2 week schools tour across the country, didn't you, talking to, I think, well over 3,000 children. I was very moved always seeing your reflections on social media of that experience. Tell us what that was like, meeting those young readers and their teachers as well.
Yeah, kids are so enthusiastic. I mean, generally, sometimes they're not, but in general, they get so excited. It helps that I give away chocolate. So
do you?
I drive them into a frenzy. It's very interactive. I show them sugar cane and a fake diamond and tea, and they have to work out. There's a quiz as well. Kids love quizzes. But yeah, and also the thing about kids, also kids' events, is you never know what they're going to ask, you know. Like, there'll be wild questions like, how much do you earn? And who's your favorite football team? And occasionally questions about the empire too. But you can never be entirely safe with kids. You never know where the questions are going to come from. And that is quite exciting for an author, because otherwise things can begin to feel a bit samey.
What experiences or interactions particularly stand out from that time?
I think it's the kids who sometimes get very emotional about what you're telling them, because they suddenly connect this history to their own family. And I got very emotional going to some schools where, you know, kids, schools that are so multicultural that there were 30 languages spoken in the schools. Mm. And at the end of one of the talks, the kids all said thank you in their own language. Mm. I thought that was so touching. And, you know, London schools are like that. And I was taught, and I grew up, you know, I went to school unable to speak English, and it was seen as a source of shame. And I found it so moving and inspiring that it's no longer seen as a source of shame. And quite rightly, people who speak two languages do better in life. They do better at school. I'm so glad. It was so inspiring for me to see that that is finally being embraced and not being used as a stick with which to beat kids from immigrant backgrounds. Mm.
It's so nice. I feel like talking to you now after this reception, you do seem more positive than perhaps you were after Empire Land, even though it did extraordinarily well. Do you think that's right?
I am, actually, which it goes against my nature because I'm quite a negative person. But I do feel positive, and it's partly because I feel like, you know, with Empire Land, I was in the middle of the culture war, this government-endorsed culture war, and every day government ministers were saying something stupid. And I feel like that's over. I feel like there's not many politicians doing it. It's basically Jacob Rees-Mogg. I feel like there's a backlash to it. I mean, we've even had Keir Starmer, you know, defend the National Trust. I feel like this culture war has kind of died. It hasn't worked. It hasn't been tested in the general election. And I feel like the population has always been more liberal on these issues than the politicians. And that is finally about to be recognized in our politics.
Okay, that is good. You are right. You do often like to have a negative take. It's very nice to hear the positivity. I mean, obviously, we're talking, Empire Land was unbelievably successful. Then Stolen History was so successful. I mean, it reached number one in the children's nonfiction paperback books. It was the best-selling children's history title published in 2023. Even after the huge success of Empire Land, did you expect that?
No, I guess I don't really measure myself by those kind of things. They're nice, but, you know, nothing competes with the reaction of readers and young people when they, you know, a young person saying they're studying history at university, you know, that is worth many, many, many thousands of sales, because you've changed someone's life there, haven't you? And that happens to me all the time. And again, it goes against my nature to focus on the positive, but I try to focus on that. Whenever someone tries to troll me, I just focus on that. I look at some of the letters I get, and it's an amazing thing.
I love it. I think you maybe have to accept that you are actually quite positive.
Oh, God, don't go that far. No way. No. No.
What about, I mean, this again is familiar to you because you're an author of a number of books, but does the excitement, if indeed it is that, of seeing the books in the shop, out in the world, does that ever diminish?
No. But I guess I've got the added thing that with Empire Land and also the sequel Empire World and Stolen History, I've seen people's minds change. Like, I think there's been a change over the last 5 years in this country when it comes to attitudes towards imperial history. Not entirely because of me, of course. I think I've played
a lot thanks to you.
I think some of it maybe, but it's been amazing to be part of something like that. I feel like loads of things have changed. I mean, the way royal tours are conducted has changed. I mean, just think back to a couple of years ago, that ridiculous royal tour of the Caribbean with Prince William, and, you know, which went wrong even in the eyes of the right-wing press. And then compare that to King Charles's tour the other week to Kenya, where he spoke about colonialism. And it was a much more healthy tour. And that's reflected in all sorts of spheres of life, in the way we talk about this stuff in schools, the improving way we talk about it in politics. I think there's been a radical change just in 5 years, and that has been a really exciting thing to be involved in.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, there has been a change. I would say you will feel there's still a long way to go.
No, I mean, there was a survey out last week which said that 6 out of 10 of British people think there should be an apology for slavery. 4 out of 10 British people think there should be reparations. 3/4 of British people think it's good to teach this history at school. All those numbers are quite high, especially considering that the knowledge of slavery and our involvement in it wasn't particularly good 5 years ago. So again, something to be very encouraged by.
Do you feel, though, I suppose, that it's frustrating that it's you who's done so much of it? I mean, your books are quite novel still in schools, aren't they?
No, I think there's a few of us. David Olusoga does amazing work. I feel like Crean Fowler, who wrote the colonialism report into the National Trust, has done really important work. And interestingly, all three of us have faced a vicious reaction. I mean, it's a matter of record that David Olusoga has a bodyguard. Crean Fowler you know, has been libeled in the press for years. At one point, had to call the police, got scared to walk down the street because of all the negative attention she was getting. And, you know, imperial historians shouldn't get this reaction. All we're trying to do is promote knowledge. Mm. You know, why are people so angry about the promotion of knowledge? I don't understand. And some of the people who are attacking us also claim to be, you know, opponents of cancel culture. But what are they trying to do? Try to cancel knowledge that is being propounded by someone like David Olusoga on BBC One, you know? The thing is, though, you cannot put knowledge back into the box. You know, you can't unlearn things. Mm-hmm. And so they've lost. I really do feel that people want to know more, because more than anything else, this history is just really interesting. You know, mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It also makes existing subjects interesting. You know, mm-hmm. like reading the novels of Jane Austen through this prism of slavery is really fascinating. And, you know, looking at how there are black people in Henry VIII's court, that's really interesting. That provides an interesting angle on a history we thought we knew. So that's another reason why this stuff isn't going to go away. It's just really, really interesting.
You talked about the vitriol leveled at people like you, David Olusoga, for writing about it. I know that your publishing team were really wary of that, weren't they, when you were bringing Stolen History into the world. Tell me about working with them and that kind of publishing journey after obviously coming out of your writing solitary confinement hole and just bringing it into the world with the team.
Yeah, I mean, Empireland got quite het up towards the end. I was not only getting a lot of abuse on social media and in handwritten letters, but also people were coming to events to shout at me. And so I stopped doing adult events. So it was a revelation to go into schools and not get that reaction, to actually be embraced enthusiastically. I've learned with Empire World that actually a lot of it's about the price of the events. If you make them too cheap, people will come and shout at you. But in general, a troll will not pay above £12.50 to come to shout at you. So I've just started doing posher events. And I've not had any hate, actually, on my during my kids' tour or during my Empire World tour. I've not had any negativity. And so, pricing is key.
I love that. I didn't expect that to be the answer. Of course, when we last spoke about it, we were at Wilderness, which you said was one of the poshest places ever. But bringing this
That was self-selecting. That was a self-selecting liberal audience, wasn't it?
Wilderness Festival. So in terms of this team, what about working with the illustrator, Jen Katoon, on the cover and the illustrations? How did you find that process? How was that as a collaboration? Did you have lots of discussions with her or let her go into her own space?
She kind of went into her own space, but the amazing thing about Kids Book is that they are collaborations, like 20 times more than adult books. Right. And that is so nice because, as you know, journalism is quiet and writing books is very lonely. It's a very lonely business. But, you know, my editor gave me a plan for the book before I started and, you know, helped me with my language. You know, I had to aim it at kids of a certain age, and it was very collaborative. Like every single part of the process was collaborative. Even the tour was hugely collaborative with the PR people, you know, helping me to write a talk suitable for kids. So that was really nice. It was much more sociable. I do struggle in general with how isolated writing gets because I do quite like people, although it doesn't always show.
No. Okay, talking about that sort of solitary experience of writing, again, I very much enjoyed watching, I do other things other than watch your social media videos, but I very much enjoyed watching when you, I think you did a penguin takeover and you took us into your writing zone. Tell people who didn't have the chance of seeing that what it is, when and where do you write? Do you have quite a specific habitual process to your writing?
I'm a bit of a nomad because I write in different places and often in different parts of the day. So I write standing up at my desk at home, but then when I get bored of that, I go and sit in a cafe, and I've got about 6 or 7 cafes near me. So I try to combine writing with physical activity, which is another, you know, challenge of writing, is that it can become very sedentary and very bad for your health.
So yes,
I walk around London writing, basically.
How do you do that?
I get a lot of steps in. I get my 10,000 steps in, and then I stop every half hour and write for a couple of hours, read or take notes. And I sometimes write on computer and I sometimes write by hand. I try to mix it up because doing one of too much of one thing can get really hamper your creativity, and it can be really bad for your health as well. There's a lot about writing that actually is similar to depression, I think, because you're often dwelling on the same thing. Quite often you're encouraged to dwell on very negative things. You're isolated. So I try to tackle it like depression. I try to make it physical. I try to make sure I have lots of daylight, and I try to make it sociable as I can.
And plants.
I mean, plants famously are good for offices and for your health. I have many, many houseplants kept alive mainly by my cleaner. Otherwise, I'd be surrounded by dead.
You know what? It's really interesting. It's interesting. You seem maybe to have a different take. A lot of writers say that you have to sit down and treat it like a 9-to-5, almost like a physical activity, but different to how you're describing. So they say it's not about necessarily wandering around and waiting for ideas to come to you. And it doesn't seem to make sense, because that's how we think of creativity, not as something that you force. Do you think that they're right? They say sit down and just wait for that impulse and that idea, those ideas to come, even if you're staring at a blank page. But perhaps you're saying go out.
I think I agree with it, but I just don't agree with the sit down bit. Sitting down is very bad for you. I stand up writing, and you can move. You don't. I think if you just sit there for hours, often nothing happens. And I'm sure it's a fact that it's been proved by science that you get more ideas when you're physically moving. I do. I have to physically move. If I walk away from a manuscript for literally an hour or two, I'll have a dozen ideas on how to change it. But if I just sit there staring at it, the solution just won't become apparent.
Okay, going back to the shortlist for this book, you've been shortlisted. You've obviously won a Nibby before for Empireland. What does it mean to you as an author to have that recognition?
Oh, God, I really embarrassed myself when I won it, because I basically cried on stage. I always complain about how those Oscar winners, you know, humiliate themselves by crying, and I was overwhelmed by emotion. So that's not going to happen again, mainly because I've been through it, and also I might not win. But it's a real honor to be shortlisted for prizes. Martin Amis said the very wise thing about awards, which is it's nice when you win them, and that's all you can say, really.
What's also incredibly encouraging is the fact that so many books of a similar sort, in terms of encouraging new ways of looking at history, bringing diverse voices back from history, are also shortlisted. And that must be very encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, these are the books that if I'd read at the age of 9 or 10, that would have changed my life. So it's exciting to tell kids this history, but part of me always feels a bit envious that I didn't have this knowledge, because I think it would have led to me having a more positive sense of myself and this country.
Very nice place to end. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Hannah. Always nice talking to you.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, make sure to subscribe to the series to hear more conversations with Nibby's authors. And we'd love it if you'd rate it and leave us a review. Do visit thebookseller.com/British-book-awards to find out more about the industry's biggest celebration of books and all who make them. This podcast was produced by Heavy Entertainment.